Morning.
All right, it is Wednesday, May 6th. We are going to be looking at the SN1, SN2, E1, and E2 reactions all in context today. And I want to call your attention. I put out an email just a couple of minutes ago, so I'm sure you guys haven't gotten it. But the email that I put out was to get you guys some resources. Let's see. There we go, chemed.study. And off the homepage, if you go to the 12AL homepage and you go to additional resources, so it's the additional resources that we're gonna go to. On here, there is nucleophilic substitution elimination guidelines. And I think I mentioned these once before, but what I did is I put the link directly in the email. So all you have to do is click on the link. So if you get lost, that's an easy way to find it. And these nucleophilic substitution guidelines, these were taken in part from a book that that I used in advanced organic chemistry that is a fantastic book. And it's called Carey and Sundberg. And it's a two-part book. It's got part A, which is structure and mechanisms, and part B, which is reactions and synthesis. And it's a great resource because all of the examples have references to the primary literature, which is great. So all of the homework problems and everything in that two-part textbook referenced all of the primary literature so that you could go up. There was no answer key for the homework. The answer key was the primary literature, and you would go into the library and we would just pull all of the old periodicals that were all bound together and go through them and find the article that we wanted to read, that actual journal article, and that was the answer key to the homework sets. And that was also one of the reasons that I like Klein so much, is that a lot of the problems within Klein have references to the literature. And I think that is so valuable because it's not just problems that have been made up. You know that these problems have foundations in real research questions that were being asked and answers that came from those research questions. So I love that type of book, and that's part of why I like Klein as much as I do. But these guidelines were taken from that, and it's a two-part, two-page guidelines. And what it has is the things that promote substitution and the things that promote eliminations. And so those various substrate, solvent, nucleophile, leaving group, temperature, all those different things that promote the different reactions are there with which items promote which reaction. And then on the second page, it has classifications of nucleophiles, so you can tell how good a nucleophile is. It has nucleophilic constants of various nucleophiles so that you can not just classify them by very good, good, fair. You can also look at it and you can know how good the nucleophile is based on a nucleophilicity number, which is a rate number. And it's up there juxtaposed against the pKa's, and you can see that pKa and nucleophilicity do not correlate at all, which is kind of a nice thing to be able to see. It also has different solvents in there, which solvents promote the bimolecular and which solvents promote the unimolecular. So it has a lot of information, and we'll look at how we're going to use that information in the context of this next thing that we're going to cover. So let me jump into that. And what we're doing here is really looking at the SN1, SN2, E1, E2. And for SN2, SN2 directly competes with E2. That these two reactions have a rate that, when I look at their rate, the rate is very similar. It has the rate of our leaving group, the concentration of our leaving group multiplied by the concentration of the base or the nucleophile. So I'll put base/nucleophile. And the difference is that when it's a base, it's E2. When it's a nucleophile, it's SN2. And other than that, they have the same rate law. So they directly compete in that regard. And the difference between an E2 versus an SN2 is whether you have a base or a nucleophile. So trying to discern between what is a base and what is a nucleophile is a big part of discerning between E2 and SN2. The second one is the SN1s and the E1s, and these directly compete with each other as well. And so the rates here are equal to K times the concentration of our leaving group, and that's it. They have the identical rate law. There's nothing different in those two. And so trying to discern between an SN1 and an E1, whenever you have an SN1, you also have an E1. And whenever you have an E1, there's also a competing SN1. Trying to figure out which one of those is major is part of what we're going to need to do. Okay, and then besides this, we have the different factors that play into this. And those factors are outlined on that sheet that I was just talking about. And the class, I jokingly sort of named it the magic sheet. I think the class sort of grabbed onto it, and it has forever since been called the magic sheet. And usually I hand it out front and back, and it's just a resource to keep on hand so that anytime you're dealing with a quiz or an exam or any of those things, having that sheet on hand so that you can go back and forth and sort of rate the different factors. The first factor is substrate. And in substrate, we're looking at what sort of substrate is it? Is it a primary, secondary, tertiary, in terms of the alkyl halide or alcohol? What does that substrate really look like? What is the makeup of that substrate? Is there additional resonance or other factors within the substrate which will promote the reactions? The next level is a level where we look at two factors together. We look at leaving group and we look at the base or nucleophile. I have a hard time breaking these two down and saying which one is more important, because I don't know that any one is more important. I think that they're both sort of equally important. And that's why I rank them together to be evaluated sort of at the same level. So what we're trying to do here is we're trying to develop a hierarchy of which of these factors is more important than the other. And what we're going to see is that it's not so easy. It's not that it's very difficult to develop an absolute hierarchy, that the hierarchy changes based on what's going on within the chemical reaction. And so while I put emphasis on substrate and saying that the substrate is of most importance, sometimes that's not true. Sometimes the base or the nucleophile becomes more important. Sometimes the solvent becomes more important. But in general, this is the way they're ranked. And then as we go through examples, we'll have to see how these rankings change. Solvent is number three, and number four is temperature. So within temperature, we're looking at high versus low. Even that, which you would think would be simple to define, just put a temperature on it, and if it's above this, it's high, and if it's below this, that's low. It's not that easy. It depends on what your leaving group is as to whether the temperature is high or low. And we'll find that one temperature for one leaving group could be high, whereas that same temperature for another leaving group could be low. So temperature is relative to the leaving group itself. Solvent is going to be nonpolar versus polar versus polar protic. So we have some differences in solvents there. Base versus nucleophile is sort of self-explanatory. Leaving group is whether it's a good leaving group or a poor leaving group. And then substrate, as we said, substrate is ranking the substrate. Is it primary, secondary, tertiary? Does it have resonance, induction? All those different factors that we could look at for the substrate. And so we're gonna have to see how those all compare and match into this. So as I promised, today is sort of gonna be a day of data. We're gonna look at a number of different pieces of data and then correlate those and try to make sense out of those in terms of the things that we've already studied to try to give us more perspective on each one of these types of reactions. So let's start it off by looking at SN2. And for this SN2, what we want to do is we want to do rates by substrate. And the reaction that we're going to look at is a reaction where we look at bromine as a bromide reacting with RBr, going to form, and this is a reversible reaction, the bromine with the star on it, which is now connected to the R group, plus Br minus. So this looks like a funny reaction to look at, but basically what we're doing is we're using an isotope of bromine. And so there are various isotopes of bromine. Bromine usually comes in a 79 or an 81 in terms of its mass number. And there are other bromine isotopes that we can use. And what we do is we put in a specific isotope of bromide such that we can compare these reaction rates by mass spec, so that when we measure the concentration of either the RBr or the isotope of bromide with the R group, we can detect their amounts using GC-MS, mass spectrometry, and we can tell how much of this reaction actually goes forward and what the rate of the chemical reaction is. And the reason that we want to do this is we want to take the leaving group and the nucleophile out of the equation. We really just want this to be about the substrate. And so by using an isotope of bromide, we can focus on what the rate effect is from the substrate itself without competing effects from any sort of nucleophile or leaving group. And when we look at the R groups, what we can do is we can look at a methyl versus an ethyl versus a propyl and an isopropyl and then a tertiary butyl. So we have each of these substrates that we're looking at. And and the ethyl, as you know, is the 2-carbon chain, the propyl, the 3-carbon chain, the isopropyl, and the tertiary butyl. And so clearly what we're doing here is we're increasing the sterics that are around this, and also increasing the nature of the leaving group, where the leaving group is, whether it's on a primary, secondary, tertiary. And so what we see here is that we have methyl, we have a primary, which is an ethyl, a primary, which is a propyl, a secondary, which is an isopropyl, and then the tertiary, which is the tert butyl. And the rates that we see are for SN2 reactions, the methyl goes at a rate, a relative rate, that is, we'll just call it 100. When we go to an ethyl, the rate drops to 1.31, meaning that SN2 reaction at a methyl is 100 times faster, almost 100 times faster than the SN2 at an ethyl. Primary to primary, even though those are both primary, the rate at methyl is that much faster because of the sterics that the ethyl group increases in the SN2 reaction. Remember that the SN2 reaction too is that the incoming nucleophile is attacking the carbon on the backside with the bromide being kicked out in this case, and I've got a bromide incoming nucleophile, and we're going through that intermediate, not intermediate, transition state, where the nucleophile is attached to the carbon and the bromide, and I'm in sort of this trigonal planar geometry, and partial minus on my nucleophile and partial minus on my bromide, and that if I increase the sterics on this to an ethyl group, what that does is it gives me free rotation about this that prohibits that nucleophile from getting in. So even though I'm looking at methyl versus ethyl, as that group gets bigger that is attached to the carbon, it makes it harder for the nucleophile to be able to get in there just due to sterics. And so the reaction slows down. When I go to propyl, it slows down even more, 0.89. When I go to isopropyl, it falls to 0.015. And when I go to tertiary butyl, it falls to 0.004. And this requires, we put an asterisk on this because it requires a protic solvent in order to make this work. And so the tertiary butyl would actually be shut down so much that it wouldn't even go if it were not for that protic solvent. So here's another way of looking at this, because those numbers don't really hit home to the degree that I would like. Let me show you in another way what's actually happening there. So if we take RBR and we react it with lithium iodide, so basically what's happening here is iodide is my incoming nucleophile. That's what my lithium iodide is doing. And what I'm getting is I connected to the R plus lithium bromide, which is coming out of this. And I look at it compared to the R group, and I look at methyl versus ethyl versus isopropyl and tertiary butyl. And now what I do is I look at this R group as a relative rate. So what I do is I take the K isopropyl and divide it by K. So I'm taking the rate of the isopropyl and dividing it by the rate of the other group. That makes my isopropyl rate 1. So this is what we call a relative rate, and we're doing it relative to isopropyl. So a relative rate to the isopropyl group. What we find is that the methyl goes 221,000 times faster, and that the ethyl is 1,350 times faster, and that the tertiary butyl does not go. When I look at those numbers before for the bromide reaction, and I'm looking at these relative rates, it's hard to see how much faster the methyl really is than the isopropyl. But when you put it into a relative rate and you make the isopropyl 1, you can see that the methyl rate is 221,000 times faster, which is an astounding amount faster. So when we say that the relative rate of an SN2 reaction, and we're looking at that relative rate, the rate of a primary is much faster than the rate of a secondary. Well, actually, we should say it this way. We should say that the primary is faster than the secondary, but that's a whole lot faster than tertiary. And we have some more data to back this up. So let's look at here just for primary substrates, SN2 on primary substrates. So now I'm not looking at secondary versus tertiary. Now what we're doing is RBR reacting with lithium iodide. Again, same reaction as we did before, making RI. But now all of these substrates are going to be primary. So what we're going to look at is we're going to look at ethyl bromide and propyl bromide, and this is isopropyl, isobutyl bromide, and then the neopentyl bromide. So all of these substrates are primary. This is an ethyl, a propyl, an isobutyl, and this one is called a neopentyl. So those are those substrates. And again, we're going to look at K over K relative. This time, we're going to divide through by the ethyl group. And that's going to make this one a relative rate of 1.0. The isopropyl falls to 0.8. The isobutyl falls to 0.036, and the neopentyl 0.0002 in terms of relative rates, which means that even for primary substrates, as the sterics increase just one carbon away from a primary substrate, the reaction rate falls dramatically. So I find that interesting too, that not all primary substrates react equally fast as well. So even branching significantly affects the rates for SN2 reactions. Okay. And so that just gives us a better understanding of the SN2 reaction and how the sterics really affect that, that we can see that particularly for primary versus secondary versus tertiary, methyl versus primary versus secondary versus tertiary, that the rates are just amazingly fast for methyl and for the primary. And then as soon as we go to a secondary and tertiary, those rates drop off significantly. And even branching can significantly affect those reaction rates at primary centers. Okay, so any questions on the SN2 reaction in terms of how important sterics is in the substrate? And this is going to this idea of why the substrate is so important is that for an SN2 reaction, primary substrates really do undergo SN2 reaction because of how quick they are to, or how low the sterics are, allowing the very fast reaction rates at the primary centers. And so substrate becomes the most important thing when trying to decide which direction a reaction is going to go. So primaries tend to always go SN2 reaction. Not always, but tend to go. We don't want to say always. Always gets us in trouble. So we try not to say that. Okay, how are we doing? Apparently we're barky. That's how we're doing. All right.
Jason?
Yeah. Matties, I can hear you. Ooh, your audio is kind of tweaky there. Do you want to put it in the chat?
Adding them to the R or are...
So I've got feedback on your audio, which I'm not able to hear you.
Yeah. Add it to the chat.
So Matthias, if you can still hear me, there was no way that audio wasn't coming through. I don't know if it came through for anybody else, but on mine, it didn't come through at all. In fact, did we lose Matthias? Did he just, no. Where'd he go? Looks like he dropped off and maybe he needed to reboot. There he is. Yeah, you're back. Awesome.
Sorry, my Wi-Fi is terrible.
Okay.
The question was, when you're writing out the substituents, are they being attached to R, or is R representing the substituent itself?
Oh, okay. R is representing the R group, if I do it this way, R group is representing the group that is here. So the R is representing the carbon chain and the length of the chain. Same thing is going on here, that I'm looking at R, that these ethyl groups, isopropyl and tertiary butyl, are representing the R group. And same thing here. So we're getting the methyl versus the ethyl, the propyl, the isopropyl, and the tertiary butyl. So R is representing the carbon chain.
Okay, so then when you're drawing in the drawing below where you have the nucleophile attacking the carbon, it was right below where you just were. Go up a little more.
This one.
That one. Yes. Yeah. Where you have the actual SN2 reaction.
Yeah.
But the one in parentheses, you're attaching the ethyl on top of that carbon.
Yes, I was making that as though this actual reaction that I'm doing here would be for this substrate, and that's what I'm mirroring here, is that that would be the ethyl group with the two hydrogens and the primary, and I'm reacting at the primary center with that ethyl group. So I chose that example to draw for that reaction.
Okay, I see.
Cool.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome. Good question. Anybody else?
Jason?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be a propyl because you got three carbons?
Oh, yeah. Okay. That would make it now better. You're right. It would have been the propyl. I could leave it as the propyl, but I kind of highlighted the ethyl and I want to make it the ethyl. So let's make it that way. And we'll put a CH3 out here and the two hydrogens. And now I'm consistent. Thank you. That was good catch. Okay. Anything else from anybody? All right, let's go and look at SN1 reactions. Let's start a new page here. So in the SN1, we want to do rates by substrate as well. So SN1 rates by substrate. And here what we're going to do is look at the sulvolysis reaction. I'll try not to trip over my words. RBR. Remember that sulvolysis is the reaction where we're looking at replacement by solvent. And so what we're going to do is we're going to do water and formic acid. Formic acid is the one carbon carboxylic acid. So it has a hydrogen and then the OH. So that's formic acid. And we're doing replacement by the water. So the actual nucleophile that we're using is the water, which is doing this component. The formic acid is an additional component of the solvent, which is going to allow for ionization and solubility of the R group. We couldn't have the R groups, the alkyl bromides would not be soluble enough without the formic acid because they wouldn't go into water. You guys know that the hydrocarbon components generally aren't soluble within the water because of the difference in the intermolecular attractive forces. So what we'll do is we'll look at the R group and we will look at methyl versus ethyl versus isopropyl and versus tertiary butyl. And we are going to do K divided by K ethyl. So we'll make the ethyl group our relative rate of number one. And what we find is that in this reaction that I get 0.6 for the methyl and the rate for the isopropyl goes up to 26, which doesn't seem like these rates are changing all that much until you hit tertiary butyl and the rate is 10 to the eighth. Is how much faster the tertiary butyl is than the methyl, ethyl, and isopropyl. It's kind of amazing. And so when we look at an SN1 reaction, the SN1 reaction, the tertiary is so much faster than the secondary, which is a lot faster than the primary. And remember that in the SN1 reaction, what's happening here is that we have whatever substrate we're undergoing here. So we can look at the methyl substrate. Let's do it this way. We can have the CH3 group. And we're looking at the rate at which this pops off to produce the carbocation. For the ethyl, we're looking at the rate at which this pops off to produce the primary carbocation. For the isopropyl, it's the rate at which this comes off to produce the secondary carbocation. And the tertiary butyl, to produce the tertiary carbocation. So we have a methyl carbocation, a primary, a secondary, and a tertiary. And what this is saying is that when I look at these relative rates, that the methyl just has an enormously high activation energy. The secondary has also a very high activation energy, but the tertiary, the activation energy is pretty small. And that is playing into that rate factor of that this guy is proceeding at 10 to the eighth, this one at 26, and this one relative at 1. It's showing the stability of the carbocation itself. And this is showing the Hammond postulate in a very understandable way in terms of the stability of the carbocation itself and how much more stable a tertiary carbocation is than a secondary. And I think too, if you remember that when we first started talking about substitution reactions, that we said that for substitution reactions in general for substitution reactions, we said that tertiary was faster than secondary, was faster than primary. But when we mapped it out, we said that for SN2 reactions, it was the other way around. Primary was faster than secondary, was faster than tertiary. And then when we go to SN1s, we find, well, that the tertiary is just a whole lot faster than secondary, which is a whole lot faster than primary. And in terms of relative rates, this was 10 to the 8th versus 29 versus 1 in a relative rate sense. And that for the SN1s, if we go back, the SN2s, if we go back and grab that SN2 relative rate, 221,000, that's 2 times 10 to the, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So this is 2 times 10 to the 5th. Versus, what was it for secondary? It was like 1,000. And then down to 1. And then this one didn't really occur. So when we said in general that tertiaries were the fastest for substitution reactions, we're really relating that back to this SN1 idea that for a tertiary substrate, it is so much faster than even an SN2 reaction for it to undergo the SN1, that's why the in general rates were different than when we broke it down to SN2 and SN1. So it's important to realize that for the SN2 reactions, we're really looking at sterics. And for the SN1, we're looking at stability of the carbocation. So one is sterics and one is electronics. Okay, let's take a look at solvent. Or unless I should ask if there's any questions, because we didn't hit any questions in terms of the SN1 rates. So maybe I should just stop for a second and say, do you guys have anything on SN1 that you want to ask? Okay, let's take a look at solvent then. So when we look at solvent, how does solvent play into these chemical reactions? In order to understand that, we need to look at the two types of reactions that we have, or the two types of transition states, because we know that by Hammond postulate, it's really all about the transition state and how stable a transition state is. Oh, a question from Eric. What is the relative rate between SN1 and SN2? Well, Eric, that's what I was trying to put in here, was in terms of the relative rates in looking at that's a harder comparison to do. I can't compare a relative rate between an SN1 and SN2 for the same substrate. What I can look at is look at SN2s and SN1s, and I can say I can say the relative rates for the SN1s and how much faster tertiary is, and the relative rates for SN2 and how much faster primary is. And the best I can do is sort of compare this 2 times 10 to the 5th versus 10 to the 8th, that for a primary substrate, the SN2 goes at like 2 times 10 to the 5th rate, whereas SN1, 10 to the 8th, and that the SN1 on a tertiary substrate is faster. But how do I choose a secondary substrate and look at the rate of SN1 and SN2? And I don't have that data. That's actually a good question of is what does that data look like? Because these are reversed, primary substrates don't undergo SN1 and tertiary substrates don't undergo SN2. So really what we would have to do is we would have to look at the secondary substrates that can undergo SN1 and SN2 and then compare the relative rates. But I don't have those numbers for you off the top of my head. I don't know that we need them. It's an interesting question, but I think that we can do what we need to do without them. Okay, let me jump in and look at these bimolecular transition states versus unimolecular transition states. So we want to do bimolecular transition state. And of the bimolecular transition states, we have the nucleophile attacking the carbon and the leaving group, and that these are partial minus on each one. And so this is our SN2 transition state. And we also have the E2 transition states, where we have the leaving group and the proton that are being pulled, and they are anti-periplanar. We have the base that is pulling this, so we have partial minus on the base, partial minus on the leaving group, and we would also have the different groups that are here that are attached to this, be them hydrogens or other groups. So this is our transition state for the E2 reaction. And what we see in both of these transition states is that both of these transition states are nonpolar. That the dipoles cancel. Much in the same way that CO2 is nonpolar. And that when I have partial minus and the dipoles oppose one another, that the dipoles cancel out when they are in opposition. And so the dipole that is here and the dipole that is here are canceling each other out in the same way that I am canceling out dipoles that are here. And so both of these bimolecular transition states are nonpolar. When I look at the unimolecular transition states, the unimolecular transition states, both of which are identical, so we only have to draw one. Here what we have is the carbon and the leaving group. The leaving group is coming off with a partial minus, the carbon a partial positive. And this transition state is polar. So this is both the E1 and the SN1. They have identical transition states. And this is somewhere between polar and ionic, because we're creating ions. As the leaving group leaves, it's becoming an ion. And as the carbocation is developing, it's also becoming an ion. So the transition state itself is polar, but it's moving towards an ionic state. These groups over here, the SN2 and the E2, they start off nonpolar and they are going to molecular in their products. So there's no development of charge or no charge that actually comes into this. Well, I guess you could say we have the leaving group, which is becoming ionic in nature, but But that depends on the leaving group itself. And so sometimes those leaving groups can be leaving as neutral molecules, as in the case of water. So how does this affect it? Well, we need to know the different types of solvents. So we need to look at solvent types. So our different solvent types that we have is we have nonpolar. We have polar. And we have polar protic. So we need to distinguish something between something which is polar and something which is polar protic. Nonpolar, we're familiar with. These are our hydrocarbons. So hydrocarbons and aromatics. The polar ones, these are things like methylene chloride, CH2Cl2, and acetone. These are our polar solvents. And then when we get into polar protic, these are things like methanol and ethanol and water and acetic acid. So acetic acid is, we abbreviate ACOH, that's the acetic acid structure being the carboxylic acid. And we call these protic because the protons, which are here, are acidic in nature. So the protic nature has to do with an acidic proton. How do I recognize an acidic proton from a non-acidic proton? These are hydrogen bonding protons. So when you think about all the different types of protons that can hydrogen bond, those are your acidic protons and those are your polar protic solvents, our hydrogen bonding type solvents. So that's how we distinguish what is polar protic. And those protons that are polar protic, it's not just that they're acidic, it's that if I have a methanol that has a deuterium on it, which is the isotope of hydrogen, let's do it as H2, and this is three hydrogens here. And I then take that H2 and react it with another methanol that has an H1 on it, such that I can track the different isotopes. And what we can do is we can even color these. Here's my deuterium. And here's my proton, that in the hydrogen bonding that is happening here, they can swap partners. And the H3CO can be bound to the H1. And then over here, the oxygen can swap and take the other proton. And so we find that these protons swap partners constantly. And that is one of the things that defines a polar protic solvent. And when we say that the proton is acidic in a way, that these protons swap very readily in and out and are constantly swapping on the oxygens. And that gives the solvent some special properties. It makes the solvent much better at solvating ions in a way. So let's take a look at how these solvents come into play now, these different solvent types, for some different types of chemical reactions. Unimolecular reactions. Unimolecular transition states are strongly affected by solvation. So that when I look at a chemical reaction, which is tertiary butyl bromide reacting in acetic acid with to become tertiary butyl acetate, And what I do here is I change the solvent. So acetic acid is my incoming nucleophile, but I also have a solvent in here. And the solvent, we are going to vary. If we keep the solvent at acetic acid, or make the solvent also acetic acid versus methanol versus formic acid, and finally we'll do water. And we look at the dielectric constant. So this symbol stands for the dielectric constant. The dielectric constant is a measure of not only the polarity of the solvent, but also the ability of the solvent to support ions. That what we see is that acetic acid has a dielectric constant of 6, methanol has a dielectric constant of 33, formic acid has a dielectric constant of 58, and water has a dielectric constant of 78. So we are in order of increasing dielectric constant. And what we're going to look at is the relative rate based on acetic acid. That acetic acid then becomes 1 because that is my relative rate measure and everything else is measured against acetic acid. Methanol is 4. Formic acid is 5,000. And water is 150,000. That what we see is that the more, excuse me, oh, those guys, when they go off, they just go off. That when we look at these relative rates, the ability of the solvent to support the ions increases the reaction rate dramatically. So what does that really mean? What are we looking at? Let's try and take this reaction and put it into context. That when we look at tertiary butyl bromide, and this guy coming off, that we go to the transition state and then to the intermediate, where the intermediate is the carbocation. And we have the bromide sitting in there. And in our transition state, we have the group leaving. And so we're somewhere in the middle here where I'm getting partial minus and partial positive. And that's my transition state. And then, of course, this reaction goes on further and goes to its product, the substitution product. Where I make the ester. And this reaction looks like this. And what we're saying is that if I have a solvent that has a high dielectric constant, that the high dielectric constant supports the formation of the developing carbocation. And so the higher the dielectric constant is, the faster the rate. So the high dielectric constant is going to stabilize the transition state. And it does so because it better solvates these guys, and they are linked by Hammond postulate. So my high dielectric constant solvents, actually that's an activation energy. Let's do a dielectric constant, which was that guy. The high dielectric constant solvates and stabilizes the cation. Solvates and stabilizes. Stable, I almost had it. Brain's not working. Okay, When I switch to a low dielectric constant, the low dielectric constant is not able to solvate these guys. And so the low dielectric constant makes these much less stable. And because it can't solvate the ions become unstable, higher in energy, and that takes the activation energy along with it. So each one of these is affecting the activation energy of the overall reaction through Hammond postulate in its ability to be able to solvate the developing carbocation. Okay, and really, when we look at that in terms of what's happening here, if we look at the carbocation and the transition state, or the developing carbocation in the transition state, and the bromide, that when we have a polar solvent, the polar solvent is trying to solvate this, and it's trying to do so with just partial minuses. And so the partial minuses are pointed towards the developing partial positive, and out here at the partial minus where the bromide is, I'm getting the other ends, I'm getting the partial positive ends of those dipole moments. And out here I'm getting the partial minuses. And so, trying to do this all accurately, plus, 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 let's put one more out here, partial minus, partial plus. And we can go through and we can say, all right, the positive sides, in looking at that dipole moment, and the minus sides in looking at those dipole moments, and how they're orienting around this guy in trying to stabilize the developing positive and the developing minus, that a polar solvent is not very good at this. But when I go to something like water, and I look at my developing partial positive and minus, that the water molecule can actually solvate this, not just through its dipole moment, but also through hydrogen bonding. And because the hydrogen bonding is so much stronger, it can really do this very effectively, and thereby stabilizing. And it's using the lone pairs to donate into that carbocation from the oxygen end, that it's very effective at doing this. And so these are also partial positives and partial minuses, but much greater in their, let's see, how do I want to do that? I think I'm just going to do it this way. That these guys, I'll make them just darker, that these guys have much more partial positive nature to them to be able to stabilize that developing partial minus, and that the developing partial positive here is offset by the greater partial minus that is on these oxygens. And so this is better at stabilizing this transition state. And so that's where the dielectric constant is really feeding into this, is it's changing the activation energy for the reaction itself based on the solvent. And so the solvent has a big effect on SN1 reactions. When we look at an SN2 reaction, what effect does solvent have on an SN2 reaction though? So this was on our SN1s, unimolecular, but what about our bimolecular? So when we look at the bimolecular, these are much less affected by solvent because the transition states are nonpolar to begin with. So we can go back and we can grab this concept. Let's take it down here and put it back down here. That because these transition states are nonpolar to begin with, that the solvation of these is not as critical. The solvation doesn't really affect the activation energy for the chemical reaction because there's no developing partial positive or negative to really affect. And so what we find is that the SN2 transition states, due to their nonpolar nature, are less affected by solvent. And that is true for E2 as well. These transition states are less affected. By solvent. Although what we find is that polar solvents are generally required for the solvation of the nucleophile. So a polar solvent is generally preferred over a nonpolar solvent. Because that leaving group is coming off as an anion. And also, not only solvation, I shouldn't say that, let's not do leaving group, let's do the nucleophile. Because the nucleophiles are often negative. So we're generally looking at polar solvents to support the nucleophile. So what we find is that when I change solvents, it can have a big effect on SN1s, but changing solvents in an SN2 generally doesn't have much of an effect. Small effects. But not big effects, not big enough to really sit down and look at all the rates and work it all out. Okay, what we do have is we can look at going back to the SN1 reactions. Let's take a look at another aspect of these SN1 reactions and these unimolecular transition states. And these are stereochemical effects. So what we're going to do here is we're going to take a substrate which has a stereocenter in it. We'll put a methyl group and a hydrogen onto this. And what we're going to do is a sulfolysis reaction. And do it in water and acetone. And we're going to vary the amount of water and the amount of acetone that are in this chemical reaction. Water is our nucleophile. This is an SN1 reaction. And what we're going to look at is the ratio of products where I get retention and where I get inversion. And remember that these are SN1 reactions. So in an SN1 reaction, I'm going through a carbocation. So we'll draw these as if we had attack from above and from below the plane. And just to remind of the mechanism, what's going on here, we're popping this group off. As that group pops off, we're going to the carbocation. The carbocation is flat and planar. So I have the CH3 group going back, the hydrogen going forward, the empty p orbital, which constitutes the positive charge. And then I can have attack of water, either from above or from below. And these lead to different products. So if I get attack from below, then that attack from below would constitute a product that we will call retention of configuration. And if I get attack from above, that is going to lead to a product that is going to be inversion of configuration. And we could also look at this in terms of this is starting out as an S. This is starting out as an S stereoisomer. This would be the S product, and the other one is going to be the R product. So we can see the inversion and retention of configuration. And what we want to do is we want to look at the different ratios of solvents. So we want to look at what happens when I vary the ratio of water to acetone. And what I get when I look at these different ratios. So we're going to do 100% water, 0% acetone, 40% water, 60% acetone, and finally 20% water and 80% acetone. And what I find is that the amount of retention starts off at 41% and 59%. So retention 41, inversion 59. And that's when I'm in 100% water. When I switch it and I go to 40-60, it becomes 47% and 53%. And when I go to 20-80, it becomes 49 and 51. Okay, what's going on here? Normally, when we look at a SN1 reaction, we say that an SN1 reaction should give a 50-50 yield because we have equal opportunity of attack from above or below. And that's what we would normally assume, is that we would normally assume that we would get 50-50, but this experiment is telling us that we don't get 50-50. And so why don't we get 50-50? That's an interesting question. And when we look at the actual group leaving, we have to realize that it takes time for the carbocation to actually develop. So as the chloride is leaving and developing partial minus and partial positive, that the chloride is partially blocking one face. So as this group is leaving and the water molecule is looking at coming in and getting in here, versus a water molecule coming from the backside, that we find that the chloride is actually an obstructing group that is in the way of the front face. And so when the solvent is 100% water, so this is at 100% water, the inversion is favored over retention. And that's just sort of a cool idea, a cool concept, that the leaving group can actually get in the way and make it hard for the incoming nucleophile to actually attack. And so that gets blocked. When I switch it and I put more acetone in, what happens is, so now this is with more acetone. The acetone is the solvent which is sitting around this, and the waters are fewer. So as this thing is coming off, and we're going to the chloride, coming off as a chloride minus, partial minus and partial positive, and there's a lot of acetones sitting around this and very few waters. Well, the acetone can't act as a nucleophile. The acetone is really just acting as a solvent in order to support the ionization and support the developing carbocation. And so all of these guys are solvents, whereas there's some waters, but there's not very many waters. What that does is decreases the rate at which the nucleophile is attacking the substrate. So as I look at each one of these water molecules, there's just not very many as compared to what I had before, where there were just waters all over this thing. And it was more likely that a water could attack from the backside as it was developing than it could attack from the front side. But when it's all acetone like this, this gives it time to fully get the chloride out of the way. And it can become then the full carbocation. And with the chloride now completely dissociated and out of the way, Now there really truly is equal opportunity for water to attack from the up face versus the bottom face. And so by increasing the amount of acetone that is in there, we find that we start getting closer and closer to a 50-50 mix because we give it time for the leaving group to actually leave. That's what's going on with that. And so we find that solvents can affect SN1. They can affect the stereochemical outcome of the SN1 in a sort of neat way. All right, app froze up, start back up, and we're back and running. Okay, any questions? I've been presenting different concepts here as we're going through. And we're gonna take these and put these all into play by looking at some problems. And I don't think that we're gonna look at problems today. We're gonna go through a couple more concepts. We need to look at nucleophilicity and nucleophiles and a couple more concepts. And then we'll spend most of the time on Monday going through examples. And I think that I'm actually gonna steal some of my lab time and use some of my lab time as problem solving sessions. So if you've been skipping out on lab time, you may not wanna skip out on the next couple of labs. Today we're gonna do a lab, but I think next week we'll start utilizing it for some extra problem solving sessions so that we can get a little more extra study time in as well, since we're ahead in lab anyway. But I want to give you a chance. Any questions in terms of this concept and what's going on here with retention versus configuration, retention versus inversion? No, you guys are quiet today. That means I'm either doing a good job or you've all walked away from your computers and you're just letting me ramble and you're going to come back and watch it later. I have no idea which is true.
Hey, Jason, I actually have a question.
Go for it.
So when you're using water as 100% salt, or when you're not using a solvent, just 100% water,
right?
It seems like it's following kind of the characteristic of an SN2 reaction because the leaving group isn't really leaving.
Actually, I like the way that you said that, because what we say here is that when we look at it in 100% water, the term that we use is that it is SN2-like in its reaction. And so that's a very astute observation that yes, that the reaction is behaving more SN2-like than it is SN1-like, and that we can have reactions that are in between, that are either SN1-like or SN2-like, and yet they have some aspects of each of those reactions. And the chloride not being fully able to leave before the nucleophile comes in makes it look more SN2-like, but still we're at 41%, 59%. If it were a true SN2 reaction, it would be 100% inversion.
Okay, I see.
So that's important to remember. So if we were actually looking at the SN2 reaction and we did this in a different way in a non-ionizing solvent, it would be 100% inversion of configuration.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
Yeah, good question, thank you. All right, let's pick up and look at nucleophilicity. And this is a silly thing that I do with nucleophilicity, but it serves a point. When we want to look at nucleophilicity and we try to correlate it with structure, and like I said, I just do this for fun, but it does serve a point, that when we look at H- is a far better nucleophile than cyanide minus. And the anion is really on the carbon. So I'm gonna move the anion over to where the carbon is. And when that is a better nucleophile than an iodide, which is a better nucleophile than a hydroxide, which is a better nucleophile than an azide, and that's better than a bromide, and that's better than a phenol. So with the phenol, we'll just draw a phenol here real quick. So we'll catch the phenol. That's a better nucleophile than a carboxylate, which is better than a chloride, or about the same as a chloride. That's better than a fluoride, And that's better than a nitrate. And that's better than water. What this serves is that nucleophilicity doesn't correlate with structure at all. That it's really challenging to look at nucleophilicity and structure and try to gain any sense out of what's a better nucleophile. That it's kind of all over the map. But we can draw some conclusions. What we can say is that nucleophilicity decreases with increasing electronegativity. So here are some general rules. Nucleophilicity decreases with increasing electronegativity. So in other words, a carbanion is a better nucleophile than is a nitrogen anion. And that's a better nucleophile than is an oxygen anion. And that's a better nucleophile than a fluoride. So we're looking at the carbon versus nitrogen versus oxygen versus fluorine. Fluorine fluoride, and that we find that nucleophilicity is decreasing with Sarah, stop texting me. This is what happens when your doctor friends start getting new information that they want you to review. That we find that as electronegativity increases, those elements hold their electrons more tightly, and because they hold their electrons more tightly, they're a poor electrophile, excuse me, nucleophile. And so that's one trend. The second trend is that anions are more nucleophilic than their conjugates. So in looking at this, hydroxide is a better nucleophile than is water. So that the anions are more nucleophilic than their conjugates. And for protic solvents, nucleophilicity increases going down a group. For protic solvents, nucleophilicity increases going down a group. This trend is a little bit harder to understand, but basically what we're saying is that when I look at hydroxide versus the sulfide, that the sulfide is the better nucleophile. So nucleophilicity is this is the better nucleophile. And that if I look at fluoride versus chloride versus bromide and iodide, that we're increasing in terms of our nucleophilicity. Okay, there's something that's counterintuitive here. Maybe you can pick out what's actually counterintuitive. Any idea?
Is it the correlation between basicity and nucleophilicity?
It's not basicity and nucleophilicity. It's a little bit different than that. When we think about a nucleophile and the nucleophile incoming, and we can think about an SN2 reaction, what is it about an SN2 reaction that's most important? What are SN2 reactions governed by? Governed by sterics, right? So think about what's happening here in this trend of size. As I go down the periodic table, size keeps getting bigger. And yet I'm saying that an iodide is a better nucleophile than is a fluoride. And the iodide is clearly bigger. The same thing is true if I'm looking at oxygen versus sulfur, that sulfur is bigger than oxygen. So why is it that the larger the nucleophile, the better the nucleophile it actually is? Because that's my size trend, is going down the periodic table is a size trend. This is because of two things. One is polarizability. So polarizability is a big factor, and the other one is a solvent factor. And so these two factors together are helping to determine this, to make this happen. So first of all, what is polarizability? Polarizability is the ability of an anion to morph, to be able to be squishy, soft. I don't know why I can never draw this the right way, the way that I can envision it in my head. So I know what I'm going to do. So polarizability is the ability of an anion to morph. The trick of having this guy, that helps. I can never draw that exactly the way I want to, which allows this thing in its ability to morph in this way, soft, squishy, such that because it's polarizable, it can get into places that it couldn't otherwise. And so while I have this incoming charge that's in here, it allows for the sterics that are pushing on this to be able to sort of like repel and cause the incoming anion to be able to morph like a balloon would morph, like you would squeeze a balloon and change its shape. That the larger the ion is, the more able it is to be soft and polarizable. So polarizability has to do with the ability, like polar, to create poles, to be able to morph itself into different shapes. And so that polarizability allows it so that it has an easier time avoiding sterics. And makes it a better nucleophile. So the more polarizable something is, the better a nucleophile it is. So that's one aspect. The second aspect is one of solvent. And of solvent, there's no more notes there. The solvent idea is an interesting idea, because when you take fluoride, fluoride is very small and hard. And when we look at something that is very small and hard tends to be very reactive, tends to be unstable. And in order to stabilize it, it needs lots of solvent molecules around it. The solvent molecules help to stabilize it. And when I look at something which is really large, like an iodide, so we've got something very small and hard here, and we've got something large and soft, delocalized. Remember that term? Delocalized means that it's more stable, requires less solvation. So there are fewer solvent molecules that are required to stabilize this. And what that means is that the fluoride, in order to be able to act as a nucleophile, has to break its solvents cage. So actually it's not attacking a nucleophile, but it's acting as a nucleophile. It has to get out of its solvent cage. And so this solvent not only helps to stabilize it, but it also cages it. And therefore, it can't act as a nuke. Whereas the iodide, because it doesn't have very many solvent ions around it, is not caged. It is free, available. And so solvation plays a role that is at least as important, if not more important, than the polarizability. So both things are true. The polarizability is also a component, but the solvation and this caging idea of being able to cage a nucleophile by the solvent prevents the nucleophile from actually acting as a nucleophile and slows the chemical rate down. Okay. Eric, you had another question. My question is, how is a molecule that is a good leaving group also be a good nucleophile? That's also a good question. And we didn't talk, the one thing that we haven't done here yet is temperature and maybe hidden temperature, but we're at 1230 and I don't have any more notes on temperature, but temperature is an equally important part too, where we start to look at the leaving group and what makes a good leaving group. Eric, I'm going to hold those over until next time. And I'm going to pick it up with your question next time. So let me make a note here. And we want to do leaving group versus nucleophile and discuss those properties of the leaving group and the nucleophile and what makes a good leaving group and what makes a good nucleophile and how those compete. And we also want to hit temperature. And then after we hit those, we're into examples, and we're going to take and just break down a bunch of examples and go through them and rate them in terms of each one of these properties and show how to use the magic sheet in order to decide whether a chemical reaction is going to go SN1, SN2, E1, or E2. So that's where we're going. We've done a lot of work today. This was a big lecture with a lot of content, a lot of dense information in it. And so we'll spend some time using all this information and hearkening back to this lecture a lot and some of these examples that we've already shown, okay? One note for those guys who are in the afternoon lab, before you check out, before you leave, this afternoon, I've got to drive my daughter someplace and she's got to be there. Let's see. I want to start the lab instead of at 2:30. Let's pick it up at 2:40. And just give me 10 minutes. I'm going to go take a drive real quick, drive my daughter, drop her off someplace, and I'll be back at 2:40. And so we'll pick it up there. And so if I'm not back at 2:40 just yet, no, I'm running in and I will be here as quickly as I can and we'll pick it up. But just give me a few minutes, Lee and see in that afternoon lab, and then we'll be ready to go. Okay. Cool. So if anybody wants to stay on the line, I'm here. I'll be here for a little bit. I'll answer a few more questions. And if not, thanks for a great lecture and thanks for participating. And I'll see you guys in the afternoon. Okay. You're welcome, Nicole. You're welcome, Anne. You're welcome, everybody. I can just sit here and say, you're welcome, you're welcome, you're welcome. See you later this afternoon. Okay. I'm going to stop the recording. Thanks a lot, you guys.